Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Spotlight Istanbul in the context of the 50th anniversary of full diplomatic relations between the Holy See and Turkey. When the courtyard of the Gentiles travelled to Tirana, marking the first Sunday in Advent on a musical note. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. In the context of celebrations for the 50th anniversary of the establishment of full relations between the Holy See and Turkey, on Monday 21st of November, a book presentation took place here in Rome. The book presented on this occasion was Istanbul, Where Two Worlds Meet, by Dr. Rinaldo Marmara. Sponsored by the St. Pio V Institute, among the speakers at the event were Vatican and Turkish authorities. For the Vatican, Cardinal Raffaele Farina, archivist and librarian of the Holy Roman Church, as well as the prefect of the Vatican Apostolic Library, Bishop Cesare Pazini. For Turkey, this nation's ambassador to the Holy See, Kenan Gurshoy, as well as the mayor of Şişli in Istanbul, Dr. Mustafa Şarikul. In the course of the evening, the figure of Blessed John the 23rd, as illustrated in Marmara's book, was discussed at length. In a special way, attention was drawn to the 10 years this pope spent as apostolic delegate to Turkey from 1935 to 1944. The spotlight was also placed on the impact his presence there had on establishing full relations between the Holy See and Turkey back in 1960. Among the speakers at this event was Cardinal Farina, who highlighted the role of culture as a bridge between different peoples and how he views it as a God-given gift. I attended this presentation and was inspired to put together a program focusing around the role of John the 23rd in bridging relations between the Vatican and Turkey with the help of sound from our Vatican Radio archives. One which begins with Pope Benedict XVI's reference to this 20th century predecessor to the See of Peter when he visited Turkey in November of 2006. It was the 28th of November, the place Turkey's capital, Ankara. And in the very first speech of his pastoral journey to Turkey, Pope Benedict XVI quoted from the writings of a pope who came before him. A Roman pontiff, who may not have visited Turkey in days when popes just didn't travel, but spent 10 years there before that as papal representative, precisely from January 1935 to December 1944. The war years, more or less. You'll have guessed with this clue, the Pope is John the 23rd, and the writings he referred to were from the journal of a soul, clearly his soul. Let's listen to Pope Benedict's words.
I have set out upon my visit to Turkey with the same sentiments as those expressed by my predecessor, Blessed John 23, when he came here as Archbishop Giuseppe Roncalli to fulfill the office of papal representative in Istanbul, and I quote him, "I am fond of the Turks," he said, "to whom the Lord has sent me. I love the Turks. I appreciate the natural qualities of these people who have their own place reserved in the march of civilization."
And the Turkish people returned this fondness to the extent of naming a street after him in Istanbul when he became pope, right by the apostolic delegation. The street is called Papa Roncalli Sukat. Being inquisitive, I went to check out the notes that Pope Benedict quotes from in the journal. What I discovered is a particularly poetic and spiritual passage, one I'd like to share with you.
"Every evening, from the window of my room, I see an assemblage of boats on the Bosphorus. They come round from the Golden Horn in tens and hundreds. They gather at a given rendezvous, and then they light up, some more brilliantly than others, offering a most impressive spectacle of colors and lights. I thought it was a festival on the sea for Bayram, which occurs just about now. But it's the organized fleet fishing for Bonito, large fish, which is said to come from far away in the Black Sea. These lights glow all night, and one can hear the cheerful voices of the fishermen. I find the sight very moving. The other night, towards 1 o'clock, it was pouring with rain, but the fishermen were still there, undeterred from their heavy toil. How ashamed we should feel, we priests, fishers of men, before such an example, to pass from the illustration to the lesson illustrated. What a vision of work, zeal and labor for the souls of men to set before our eyes. Very little is left in this land of the kingdom of Jesus Christ, debris and seeds, but innumerable souls to be won for Christ, lost in this weltering mass of Muslims, Jews, and Orthodox. We must do as the fishermen of the Bosphorus do, work night and day, with our torches lit, each in his own little boat, at the orders of our spiritual leaders. That is our grave and solemn duty.
Having read this journal, I remembered I once met a person to have lived in both of Roncalli's residences, his townhouse and his summer house. Looking out of his windows onto the Bosphorus and actually leafing through his personal books and indeed footnotes within them. He's the late Monsignor Charles Burton Mouton, a former Vatican diplomat who once shared with me vivid memories of this Turkish experience.
I live in Pope John XXIII's house in Istanbul, and in his summer villa on Büyükada, on the Princess Islands in the Sea of Marmara. Very lovely villa on this island, a four-story villa with a walled garden. And I would sometimes open a book in the library, and there was a notation in his handwriting, and you felt like you were really living with him in a way, because of the memories that were in those places and in those two residences. And Pope John XXIII renovated the villa and spent 8 or 9 summers there, became very attached to it, as he became very attached to the Turkish people. And it was through Pope John XXIII that diplomatic relations were established between Turkey and the Holy See. But he left, of course, a very wonderful memory in Turkey among all of the people. And of course, it's a non-Christian country. It's a Muslim country. But he had great respect among them. And of course, Pope John XXIII had very great interest in ecumenism and in establishing the various offices in the Holy See, which would deal with ecumenical subjects. And I think that had to do with the time that he spent in Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey. He had contact with the Orthodox Church and with the Muslim world. And I think that had a lot to do with his formation and with his view of ecumenism and relations with the Orthodox and relations with the Muslims and the non-Christian religions.
Pope John XXIII wasn't the only Roman pontiff of the 20th century. Pope Benedict XVI mentioned on his first day in Turkey's capital, Ankara. During his speech to diplomats, in fact, he also mentioned Benedict XV, whom he described on this occasion as an untiring promoter of peace during World War I. A pope who was much misunderstood during his pontificate, but who, as his biographer John Pollard writes, the Turkish people remember in a special way. Quote, "He got very little in the way of reward during the course of the conflict. On the contrary, he was attacked from all sides. However, ironically, the lasting monument to his humanitarian efforts came at the time not in any European state, but in Turkey of all places. In Istanbul, a statue was erected in his honour even before the war." Unquote. No surprise, then, that Pope Benedict XVI mentioned his predecessor during a gathering with roughly 90 ambassadors in Ankara. Also in light of that first general audience of his pontificate back on the 27th of April 2005.
Benedetto.
I wanted to be called Benedict the 16th in order to create a spiritual bond with Benedict the 15th.
Al venerato pontefice Benedetto XV,
who steered the church through the period of turmoil caused by the First World War. He was a courageous and authentic prophet of peace and strove with brave courage, first of all, to avert the tragedy of the war, then to limit its harmful consequences. Treading in his footsteps, I would like to place my ministry at the service of reconciliation and harmony between persons and peoples, since I am profoundly convinced that the great good of peace is first and foremost a gift of God, a precious but unfortunately fragile gift to pray for, safeguard, and build up day by day with the help of all.
Words these that came to my mind as Pope Benedict XVI then addressed diplomats on his first day in Turkey, during a gathering with roughly 90 ambassadors. Respectful dialogue, he said on this occasion, must be the basis for ending terrorism, wars, and religious differences in the world. Religions, he added, have a key role in this dialogue, but on the condition that they utterly refuse to sanction recourse to violence as a legitimate expression of religion. Perhaps one can safely say once again that Pope Benedict is doing his best, as promised at the beginning of his pontificate, to tread in the footsteps of that last pope to bear the name Benedict. From the 14th to the 15th of November, the Courtyard of the Gentiles project, sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Culture, whose president is Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, travelled to Albania's capital, Tirana, to discuss what non-believers believe in. On the 14th, the courtyard was located in Tirana's Cathedral Square, where three marquees were set up to debate three different issues: work ethics, spirituality, and media. On the second day, the courtyard moved to the students' hall of two different Albanian universities. Claudia Bumci of our Albanian programme travelled with the courtyard to Tirana, reporting on these events, witnessing them firsthand. I spoke to her following her return and began by asking her something about the Tirana she grew up in. Claudia Bumci, you're Albanian. You were born in Tirana when there was an atheist regime. It was atheist by constitution, is that correct?
Yes, the regime was established in 1945. After the Second World War, and I was born just a month after the regime decided to close all the churches, all the mosques, and decided to be atheist, decided that the religion was not important anymore for Albania and for Albanian people. They baptized me in my apartment in Tirana without any witness.
Claudia explained to me how when she received the sacrament of baptism at the hands of an undercover priest in the safety of her home, so bad was persecution in Albania at the time that even witnessing such an event might cost a stint in jail.
So that was the situation when I was born.
So it was a regime of persecution of Catholics and of people who belong to other religions as well, no?
Yes, they put in prison priests, nuns, and other religious people, even lay people who proclaim their faith. For example, when I was in high school, I said once that I was of Catholic origin, and I risked to be expelled from all of the schools of Albania. It was my teacher that loved me, that said to the director, "No, I haven't heard that word from her, so somebody lied."
So she denied it.
Yeah, she denied it, and I was saved.
So interestingly then, you went back to Tirana just recently. to cover an interesting story for the courtyard of the Gentiles Project. What do non-believers believe in? It's kind of ironic, you know, the change of shift from your childhood and your school years to what you were reporting on now as a journalist.
It was really interesting because when the regime ended at 1990, the Catholics were not what they were once for the society. That means the elite of the society. Because the regime, of course, didn't permit to their children to go to the university to become anybody.
It's a communist process, isn't it? It happened elsewhere as well, to stunt people's intellectual growth, Catholics' intellectual growth in this case.
Exactly. And now the Catholics are again looking for a new contribution to the society. I have found Catholics in the government. I have found Catholics in the parliament. I have found Catholics as philosophers, as sociologists. And they...
So you say this with an element of surprise.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. They have done even an analysis of the society that I would never expect, because they were not there just for the sake of being, you know, just to say what their theories could be on the theme of the courtyard of the Gentiles, but they analyzes the society, putting their fingers to problems to be solved in a certain way, and they proposed even the ways. For example, on November 14th, there were a great feast of the youth in the courtyard near to the St. Paul's Cathedral in Tirana. They have set up three tents, one on labor, one on spirituality, and one on media world. And they said, for example, the young people, but even the philosophers and other intellectuals that were there, said that, for example, one interesting thing could be teaching ethics from the fifth class of the school. Now they don't do it like this. But the problems of Albania, the global crisis, and what they lived with communism...
The legacy of communism.
Yes, made them think that ethics are really important in the life of society and not only just as knowledge, you know. They have asked to the church to have a special attention for the Catholic of nowadays, because they have passed through the communist regime and they have experienced the survival of the faith without the institution. So the relationship of the Albanian Catholic with the institution of the church is different from the relationship of another Catholic that lives, for example, in Italy. Another thing that they said, the Albanian Catholic is more lay in respect of a Catholic in other parts of the world.
What does that mean?
Because there are different religions in Albania. So, for example, if Catholics ask for religion teaching in the school, of course, that would be even for Muslims, for Orthodox, for Bektashi, for Evangelicals, and so on. So it's not possible to do something like that.
But are Catholics a minority? Or
Catholics are, let's say, 13% of the
population.
The
religious makeup.
Yes, yes. 20% are Orthodox and the rest are principally Muslims. And now we have Evangelicals and Protestants in general.
Muslims because of the Ottoman legacy, no?
Yes, yes.
There's a reason for that.
Yes. In fact, you cannot find fundamentalists in Albania because they are of Turkish tradition. They are Muslims, but I mean, they recognize human rights and all the discussions done in the Western countries.
What struck you most about this meeting, which was presided over by Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, you know?
Yeah, well, if I have to choose, I would choose the curiosity of the people. I mean, people didn't know very well what does it mean, dialogue between believers and not believers. But they have seen these three tents. They have seen the stage with religious leaders, artistic expression of the different religions in Albania, and they had the curiosity to know what these people were doing there. They came in the courtyard and then they stayed to listen. So it was really very cold in Albania that Monday, but people stayed there till 9:30 p.m. And even the religious leaders said, okay, you are staying here even if it's really very cold. That means that you are strong believers, or what we are saying is so interesting that don't permit you to go away.
Claudio, the second day, on the 15th of October, the courtyard of the Gentiles moved to Tirana's university's familiar place for you, perhaps.
One is a State University of Tirana. I have done the State University of Tirana too. The other is the European University.
So there were two universities.
Private, yes, is a private university, but it offers a good level of education. It was really interesting because even the professors of the universities gave a testimony of their faith during communism and after communism. At the European University, we had more non-believers. One of them especially have quoted Pope Paul VI, Pope Benedict XVI, and spoke about universal brotherhood. Now, I understood that that was a discussion made for the occasion, but he felt that he could not afford a discussion on non-believings with the believers.
So can I ask you one last question? The theme of the two-day event focused precisely around what non-believers believe in. Did any one of these non-believers reply to that question specifically?
Well, they said that they believe in something else. So, for example, in universal brotherhood, in ethics. So these are meeting points with the believers. Mm-hmm. So about these values, we can discuss with them. But don't ask them to believe in God. I mean, they believe in all the values of the believers, but not in God because they cannot see God. That was the point.
And I was speaking there to Claudia Bumci, who's just returned from Tirana, where she witnessed firsthand the courtyard of the Gentiles project. Finally, why not end the programme on a musical note as we look ahead to the first Sunday in Advent, the beginning of our liturgical year. That's with music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
A generation or two ago, a very unpopular job among seminary students was ringing the bell first thing in the morning to get everyone out of bed. The reason it was unpopular, of course, was that it meant getting up even earlier, so as to be ready on time. At the start of Advent, we hear again and again the call to wake up, to get ready, to prepare ourselves for the day that is dawning. We all know how hard that can be if we're feeling sleepy. But we all know how necessary it is if we have something important to do. What could be more important than being ready to greet our Saviour when he comes? Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Awake, a voice is calling. That's the title of an old German hymn for Advent. The version we just heard was arranged by Michael Praetorius early in the 17th century, but probably more familiar to modern listeners is the arrangement made by J.S. Bach 100 years later. If any of you have worked with church choirs or liturgy planning groups, you'll know how hard it can be to prepare the music Sunday after Sunday for public worship. Imagine what it would be like if you had to compose the music as well. But that's exactly what J.S. Bach did for most of his life. He wrote his cantatas for use during the Sunday liturgy in Weimar and in Leipzig, often producing a new one each week. The cantata he wrote for the last Sunday of November in 1731 was Wachet auf, and he based a lot of the music on the tune we've been listening to. Now, I bet some of you are thinking, yes, it's lovely music, but it doesn't sound much like the tune we heard before. Wait for it. Bach is setting the scene with a beautiful counter melody, preparing the way for the coming of the tune. Here it is, in long, slow notes, in the voice parts. Listen now to a passage a bit later on, where Bach sets the second verse. Zion hears the watchman singing. That's the counter melody. Now for the tune. Many people find the spiritual quality of Bach's music a great help with their prayer. It can settle us into a recollected frame of mind. If you get the chance, you may like to listen to a recording of Bach's cantata Wachet auf as part of your Advent devotion. At the heart of it is a dialogue between Christ and the soul. When the heavenly bridegroom comes, he invites the soul to join him at the wedding feast. No eye has ever seen, no ear has ever heard such joy as this.
And warm thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Laudetur Jesus Christus.